fasten your seatbelts, and turn up your radio. We're going on a road trip. Vaccination rates in central and northern Wisconsin lag behind national goals, especially for children living in rural areas. State figures show an increasing number of parents in our area are skipping vaccines for their children, getting a waiver from school requirements based on personal conviction, an exemption allowed in just 18 states. Welcome to Route 51. I'm Shereen Seward. Today we'll talk about immunization and immunity in central and northern Wisconsin, along with efforts underway to boost vaccination rates. Joining me today is Portage County Division of Public Health Nursing Supervisor Melanie Baer, who will help explain the existing state of immunity, along with a new proposed state rule that would require all students to be vaccinated against meningitis before seventh grade. In this first segment, we're also joined by State Senator Patrick Teston, the Republican from Stevens Point, who is sponsoring a bill that would allow trained pharmacists to vaccinate children with a doctor's prescription, a change from current rules. Later in the program, we'll be joined by Dr. Jonathan Tempte, a UW-Madison expert on vaccination and microbiology, for a scientific look at the vaccination debate. Melanie and Senator Teston, welcome to Route 51.
Great to be on. Thank you.
We'll take your calls and questions, too. Join the conversation by calling 800-780-9742. Now, specific goals vary by disease, but the World Health Organization and others aim for 90 to 95% vaccine coverage to keep herd immunity strong. But many schools in our area have dipped below that rate. And the latest figures show that more than 800 schools in our state have coverage rates below 80%. So, Melanie, my first question for you, what does that mean from a public health standpoint when schools have coverage rates that dip to those levels?
I think what it means for the state overall is that the herd immunity, which is a herd immunity, serves as a buffer for those folks out there who do not have either current vaccinations to prevent them from getting an illness, or those folks who have some sort of disease that may be immunocompromised. In the schools specifically, if you have students that are attending schools that are not vaccinated or maybe are suffering from a disease that causes their immunity to be down, it puts those students at risk for developing diseases such as pertussis or whooping cough, measles, any of the vaccine-preventable diseases that a long time ago were causing death. So I think that's really what we're looking at, is that decline in the herd immunity. And so there's a lot of citizens out there that are not protected.
Senator Teston, you are introducing Senate Bill 110. It's legislation that would change some existing rules on who could administer vaccines. So exactly what does this bill propose to do?
So essentially what this bill aims to do is increase access. So first off, I want to make clear that this is not a mandate. Essentially, we just want to make sure that in underserved areas, such as rural parts of the state, that pharmacists and pharmacy students, under the watchful eye of a licensed pharmacist who's been trained to administer vaccines, can give those. Because some residents in the state, oftentimes their pharmacist is the healthcare professional that they see most often when they go to their local pharmacy. And so it's really about giving residents here in the state of Wisconsin more opportunities that they want to get vaccinated to do so.
How do you think that these new rules would impact people living in rural areas? That seems to be one of the biggest areas that have difficulty in reaching those immunization goals.
Right. So as you kind of alluded to, our vaccination rates are well below the national average, especially here in the Midwest. And so oftentimes, for folks that live in more remote areas of the state, going to see your doctor could be upwards of a two-hour or even longer round trip. Whereas if they go into their local pharmacy, they pick up their prescription, they can also, provided they've been prescribed the vaccination from their doctor, have that vaccination administered from a licensed pharmacist who has been trained to administer vaccines. When we heard testimony on this bill earlier in the session, we heard a lot of stories, compelling stories from individuals who talked about how difficult it is for them to go and see their doctor. But by having this ability to go in and get your flu shot or any other type of vaccination that's been prescribed to them from any physician, they see this as an opportunity for them to get more coverage.
So with more rural clinics closing and more difficult situations that are emerging for people in those areas to access doctors, is telemedicine going to play a role here?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, that's one of the goals that we really tried to focus on within the state budget was to increase access to telemedicine. Now, unfortunately, that was subject to a line item veto from the governor, but there is standalone legislation that's working its way through both houses that I am hopeful we can get through, because with advances in technology, things like telemedicine ensure that residents in underserved areas, particularly in rural areas, can gain access without having to go and take the long drive, or if transportation is an issue, to their doctor, that they can connect via their iPhone or other type of smart device and be able to get a consult and get the help that they need from their physician.
Melanie, what's your view on this bill from a public health perspective? Is this going to make a difference?
I think it's an excellent opportunity. We have clients all the time that are calling the health department looking for vaccinations, and we are limited as to who we can vaccinate as far as eligibility for vaccine. We do refer a lot of clients to pharmacies, especially adults, to go to the pharmacy to get their vaccinations. Sometimes it's a matter of access, as Senator Tessin said. Maybe they don't have the transportation, or they don't have the time to make an appointment for themselves to get to wait for a doctor's appointment or a nurse to give that shot. So I think even opening up the door for students to be able to be vaccinated and small children, I think it's excellent. And that may be improving the access, maybe one way that we can maybe boost our immunization rates in the county.
So Pat, how do you think this is going to be rolled out? How do you envision this? Like, what kind of training is going to be necessary to make this work?
Well, the training standards are set by, I believe, the state. So the infrastructure is already in place for pharmacists to vaccinate. In fact, in testimony that we heard in the Senate Health and Human Services Committee earlier this year, we had heard that in some cases, pharmacists are doing a large number of vaccinations within their practice. And so it's already in place. And so as far as the legislation is concerned, it's actually passed out of the assembly. And I believe, as I looked it up, it passed on a voice vote. So there was no opposition. It passed unanimously out of the Senate Health and Human Services Committee. Now it's just a matter of getting it scheduled for the Senate floor this fall.
So you are seeing bipartisan support for this?
Yeah, I think by and large, this is not a partisan issue. And I think we're trying to do everything that we can to increase access for our citizens in the state. And if people want to get vaccinated, we just want to increase that access and ensure that we boost our immunization rates.
All right, Pat, I'd like to ask you, I just have to talk about personal exemptions for a minute, because Wisconsin, one of 17 states that allow parents to opt out of vaccinations, not just for medical or religious reasons, but because of personal conviction as well. I know that there has been talk over the years at the state level of eliminating that personal exemption rule. Do you see that effort gaining any traction?
You know, I think right now there was actually legislation introduced by Assembly Minority Leader Gordon Hintz that would remove the personal exemption. And anytime that discussion gets brought up, it elicits a lot of emotion, both for and against, on the issue. Now, where the bill was referred to in the state assembly, the committee chaired by State Representative Chuck Wichgers, he is not a proponent of this proposal, and he said he is not going to hear the bill. And the bill has been referred in the Senate to my committee, the Health and Human Services Committee. And given the fact that the Assembly Committee has been referred to basically said he's going to kill the bill, I don't see this bill moving forward this session at all.
Okay. Are there any other changes you'd like to see at the state level regarding vaccination? Is there any other effort that lawmakers could undergo to help boost vaccination rates, in your opinion?
You know, really, I think trying to increase access is a great first step, but then relying on our local partners and getting feedback from our county health departments to see if there's any other avenues that we can pursue that can actually gain traction and hopefully get through both houses, I'm all ears on.
Okay. Melanie, you mentioned access to vaccinations. We talked about that during this segment. How big an issue is access for families?
I think it's one of the largest issues that we are facing in Portage County itself. We not only see access, I mean, for children, but access for adults is an issue. We have a lot of folks that live in rural communities that do not have a means for getting into the Stevens Point area to access their physicians. So I think it is definitely an influence on vaccine rates for us.
Okay. And Pat, I guess bottom line, why do you think that the existing rules need to be changed?
Well, as it was just mentioned, I mean, we have a lot of underserved areas. And as has been pointed out several times now, whether it's transportation, whether it's an issue of just the inability to go into your doctor's office when you have to get a vaccination, our hometown pharmacists are really oftentimes the front line within the medical community. And so by allowing individuals to go into their pharmacy and have their pharmacist who's licensed and trained to give vaccines, I think is a great step in ensuring that for those who want to get vaccinated have that opportunity to increase access and make sure that these people are getting what they want.
So just to be clear, right now I can go to a pharmacy and get a flu shot if I want one, but my child could not get a shot at a pharmacy right now. Is that correct?
If they're under the age of 6, and what this legislation aims to do would remove that age restriction. So provided, you know, it's an approved vaccination, provided it's been prescribed by a practicing physician, that age restriction would be removed and you'd have that ability to have your child vaccinated.
Okay, so that is Senate Bill 110. We'll be watching to see what happens next. We do have to take a break. Senator Patrick Teston, thank you for joining us today on Route 51. I know that you have to drop off here. When we return, we'll continue the conversation with Portage County Public Health Nursing Supervisor Melanie Baer on the state of immunization in central and northern Wisconsin. We'll also be joined in a bit by Dr. Jonathan Tempte. He is a UW-Madison expert on vaccination and microbiology. He'll offer up a scientific view on the vaccination issue. We'll also hear comments from Amber Pesquette. She is co-founder of Wisconsin United for Freedom. It's a group that opposes the state's new proposed meningitis vaccine requirement for all students entering seventh grade. You can join the conversation, too. You're welcome to call 800-780-9742. I'm Shereen Seward, and this is Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio. We're back on Route 51. I'm Shereen Seward. Portage County Public Health Nursing Supervisor Melanie Baer is with us today as we continue our discussion on vaccination. A little later in the program, we'll welcome Dr. Jonathan Tempte. He's a UW-Madison expert on vaccination and microbiology. He'll offer a look at the science behind the vaccination debate. We'll welcome your calls and questions, too. The number to call is 800-780-9742 if you've got a question or you'd like to weigh in. So, Melanie, which vaccinations are currently required for students in Wisconsin schools?
Currently, what is required is the DTaP, which is the diphtheria, tetanus, and pertussis, the polio vaccine, the MMR, which is measles, mumps, and rubella, the Hib, hepatitis B, and varicella.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Are vaccinations required for both public and private schools? Are all the regulations the same regardless?
Excuse me, say the question again.
Sure. I'm wondering if the vaccination requirements are for both public and private schools in Wisconsin.
Yes. The recommendations that the ACIP puts out, or the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, yes, they are the same for public and private schools.
So statewide, we're seeing data that shows an uptick in the number of parents that are opting out of vaccinations for either religious or personal reasons. So do you know what those numbers look like in Portage County?
In Portage County, we are pretty much mimicking what the state is seeing. In general, I can say that our school vaccination rates in Stevens Point, it's about 95%. In our outlying areas, anywhere from 87 to 94%. And the students that are, or parents that are submitting waivers, hangs around 4 to 5%.
What does the CDC recommend from a numbers standpoint?
The CDC, of course, would like to see about a 95% immunization rate, which would mean, 5% or less for waivers. Mm-hmm. So we are hitting about the national average.
Okay. I guess, what about the flu vaccine? So the CDC recommends a 70% vaccination rate. Where do we stand here? Do you know?
Our flu vaccine, unfortunately, we are much lower than that. Last year, we held a influenza vaccination rate, and our immunization rates for the teens, for example, hits about 33%. The elderly population is somewhere between 27 and 30%, and it's a little bit higher in the younger age group, and I think that may be related to the fact that those children are, they are seeing their physicians on a routine basis, and so those rates are a little higher for, say, those kids 4 years of age and under.
So I guess I'm curious about the numbers. When we say a school is at 80% or 85%, mm-hmm. How significant is that from a public health standpoint? How significant are those changes in percentages?
Well, I think if you look at a school, say, for example, that has an 87% rate of children that meet the minimum requirements, that means that they have met the requirements for attending school or the recommendations for entering the school system. That leaves about 13% of the population that is unprotected. So, for example, for the measles, the upsurge of measles that we've seen recently, it puts 13% of that population at risk, especially if they're not covered by the measles vaccination, at risk for developing measles, which could lead to a serious illness for a lot of students.
Have you seen measles in central and northern Wisconsin?
We have not seen, as the rest of the country has seen. We have been lucky. So I'll knock on wood and hope that we are not seeing it this year. We've been protected so far.
Okay. Mumps, too?
Yeah. We've very minimal. I'm trying to think of the last confirmed case we had in the school. And I've been here 12 years, so.
Okay.
So we're still protected there, too.
Okay. We are welcoming Dr. Jonathan Tempte, UW-Madison expert on vaccination and microbiology, for a look at the science behind the vaccination debate. Dr. Tempte, thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me this morning.
Yeah, so we're continuing our discussion on vaccination and kind of the debate around that. And I'd really like to ask you to start with explaining how vaccinations work.
Vaccinations are a wonderful medical invention that have been with us for roughly the last 200 plus years. But they work by basically taking our own bodies and our own body's defense system and preempting what happens when we're normally exposed to, let's say, a virus or a bacteria. When we get exposed, for example, to measles virus, pertinent to what your previous guest was just talking about, our bodies respond by creating chemicals called antibodies that will attack the invading organism and allow our body to contain that infection. We can then take either parts of bacteria or killed viruses, or sometimes what we call live attenuated viruses that have been weakened, and expose our bodies to those compounds. And by doing so, we activate our immune system to create those antibodies in preparation for a natural exposure. And so this happens all the time. For example, if I, and I can go back to my high school days, I came down with chickenpox, and I had a whopping case of chickenpox. But in the aftermath of that, my body was protected from chickenpox going forward.
Okay. Okay. I remember having chicken pox when I was in eighth grade. It was terrible.
Absolutely.
Yes. One thing I wanted to talk about is herd immunity. We hear a lot about herd immunity. Can you explain what herd immunity is?
I sure can. And those purists out there, we no longer use herd immunity, but we use the herd effect.
Okay.
But basically, this says that when there are enough individuals around us in a population that are already immune to something, it prevents that virus or bacterial infection in having a chance to propagate well through the population. The tricky part is that the number of people who have to be immunized or protected depends on the organism. And the rule of thumb is something that is more contagious requires a higher percent of the population to be immune. So, for example, measles is one of the most contagious viruses known to humankind. And because of that, we have to have our population protected at a level of somewhere between 93 and 95% to prevent that virus from getting in and propagating and making people sick.
And we know that many of our schools in Wisconsin are dropping below 80%. So it's interesting to hear that number.
Well, exactly. And if you look at the current measles outbreak across the country, where we have now had more cases in 2019 than we have had in any year going back to 1992. But if you get under the skin of that and look more directly, many of those cases are located within communities where they have very low vaccination rates and very low protection. And once a case lands there, it can just explode over the course of just a few weeks.
Okay. I want to shift to the meningococcal vaccine, because there is a proposal by the State Department of Health Services, a new rule that would require children to be vaccinated against meningitis to receive this vaccine by the time they enter seventh grade. There were public hearings on it earlier this month, and I spoke with Amber Pasquette. She is co-founder of Wisconsin United for Freedom. It's a group that opposes vaccinations for a variety of reasons. I'd like you to listen to what Amber had to say specifically about this vaccine.
The vaccine itself, it doesn't, as we discussed, it doesn't contribute to herd immunity, and this is even per the CDC. You can look this up on their website. So it's more of an individual protection, if you will. So the fact that it's being mandated for all children across the board, when it only really protects the individual, that just doesn't make sense to me. It should be a choice. So therein lies the freedom of choice. We should be able, not only should we be able to choose any vaccine, obviously, vaccines in itself are essentially medical procedures. We should, reserve the right to be able to refuse them if we wish.
So we'll hear a little bit more from Amber later. That's Amber Pasquette. She is co-founder of Wisconsin United for Freedom. What are your thoughts on those comments? Is it true that meningitis vaccine doesn't contribute to that herd immunity? I'm using the wrong term, I know. The herd effect.
Yes and no. For example, when we do have a case of meningococcal disease, and it can be either meningitis or more commonly a bloodstream infection. That is a public health emergency. And one of the things that happens in the aftermath of a case detection is going out and putting everybody with contact with that individual on prophylactic antibiotic, because this is a contagious bacteria. That being said, your speaker was correct in saying that, by and large, what we're doing is protecting most of the time against bacteria that many of us carry already in our nasal cavity. And so when we see cases of meningococcal disease, they're usually a homegrown situation. And we don't have good evidence that by vaccinating a population, we necessarily decrease the amount of the bacteria living within us. So it's a complicated issue. On the flip side, had you had a speaker, for example, from the Meningitis Angels or the National Meningitis Foundation, who have had children who have gone from feeling well one day to being in an intensive care unit 24 hours later or dead 24 hours later, you'd get a very, very different point of view. So these are always complex situations. However, I just want to remind listeners that it is established through Supreme Court precedent that states do have the ability to mandate vaccines for public health purposes.
Okay, and listeners can call in. 800-780-9742 is the number to join in the conversation. Melanie, you heard Amber's comments. What are your thoughts on that?
My thoughts are very similar to what the doctor said. It isn't a vaccine that is categorized with the herd effect. However, we do have students within the population of our schools that are very vulnerable. And so while states can require or recommend vaccines, I do think it is important that when parents are considering vaccinating their child, that they also think about the remainder of the population that is in the school system, because as the doctor said, meningococcal B can be, or Neisseria meningitis can be very devastating to families and the patients who acquire it.
Okay. I want to play the rest of my conversation with Amber. Amber Prescott, again, she is co-founder of Wisconsin United for Freedom. The group is opposed to vaccines for personal reasons. And she kind of outlines many of the arguments that we hear from people who are opposed to vaccines. So here's what Amber had to say.
Just for me, it's a safety issue. They haven't been cumulatively tested for safety nor efficacy. The entire schedule from birth to 18 years has not been tested. And there's a lot of foreign matter that's in vaccines. Some vaccines are derived from aborted fetal cells. So I'm not comfortable with injecting foreign DNA into my children or myself for that matter. There's things like formaldehyde, which if I was to drink a cup of it, it would be bad, right? But if I was to inject it, it's okay. There's a lot of contradictions that just don't fit well with me, as well as the fact that vaccine injury is real. There is an entire fund set up by the government that's funded by the taxpayers that to date has paid over $4 billion for vaccine injury and death. In 1986, Ronald Reagan signed an act into law that removed all liability from vaccine manufacturers. So it's such a big picture. It's not just an open and closed case. It's not just a one-size-fits-all schedule. It's safe and effective for everybody. There's so many different factors involved. So for me, we abstain as a family.
That is Amber Prescott, co-founder of Wisconsin United for Freedom. I know there's a lot to unpack there. She had a lot of things to say. But one of the points that she wanted to bring up was that, in her opinion, vaccines aren't tested for safety. So how safe in general our vaccines, how can we be sure they're safe?
Well, I'll jump in with this one. And I'm a family physician over the last 26 years. I've also spent 12 years of my life sitting on the national committee that makes recommendations for the United States. I chaired that committee for the last 3 years I was on it. And to be honest, I have to give this disclosure. I came in as a family physician, and I started out as being what I would call a vaccine nihilist. I didn't have a great deal of training. I wasn't a firm believer. But in 1990, in the year 2000, I was asked by the American Academy of Family Physicians to sit on a committee that evaluated evidence and determined that measles was eliminated in the United States. And by elimination, mm-hmm. it means that the conditions were set that measles did not propagate because of the availability of an incredibly safe and incredibly effective vaccine. That was a turning table, but I spent 4 years as a liaison to the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, and then I was a voting member for 8 years. On my time there, the first job I had was chairing a MMRV, the Measles, Mumps, Rubella, and Varicella Safety Work Group, and we evaluated safety. I learned more about vaccine safety than probably 99.9% of people in the state of Wisconsin. So this is something I feel really comfortable with. I will agree with Amber absolutely that vaccines are not 100% safe. As a practicing family physician, nothing of what I prescribe is 100% safe. When I send somebody for a screening colonoscopy, I do so with the knowledge that 4 out of 1,000 of my patients will end up with an intestinal perforation, which is a medical emergency. When I put somebody on a blood thinner for a blood clot, I do so knowing that probably 1 out of 20 will have a bleed from that. So medicine is not a situation where we do things with the guarantee of safety. We as physicians, unfortunately, cause a lot of harm out there in our attempts to do good. That being said, of all the things that we do medically in this country, the safest component is that of vaccines. Vaccines are regulated and they are scrutinized more than any other medical device, any other pharmaceutical product, or any other intervention we choose to take in medicine. So they are not 100% safe, but they are incredibly safe. As far as the statement that the entire childhood schedule has never been scrutinized, this was something that the Institute of Medicine, called in by Congress, has evaluated all the evidence, and their conclusion was the entirety of the childhood schedule is not only safe, but effective, and it has been life-saving, it has been disease-saving, it has been hospital-saving. So these are all things that I wish people would take the time to actually read the objective evidence out there as opposed to highly biased websites.
Okay, we'll continue this conversation after a break. Portage County Public Health Nursing Supervisor Melanie Baer and UW Medicine vaccination and microbiology expert Dr. Jonathan Tempte, our guest today, as we continue our discussion on vaccination in central and northern Wisconsin. You can join the conversation, too, at 800-780-9742. I'm Shereen Seward. This is Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio. We're back on Route 51. I'm Shereen Seward. Portage County Public Health Nursing Supervisor Melanie Baer and UW-Madison vaccination and microbiology expert Dr. Jonathan Tempte are our guests today as we explore the vaccination debate. We'd love to hear from you, too. The number to call is 800-780-9742. We heard from Amber Frisket earlier. We'll get back to that. One thing I wanted to ask Melanie, of the vaccines that are required of children now, are there certain vaccines that are more important, in your view, to protect the public as a whole?
Oh, boy, that's kind of a loaded question.
Probably.
I would say no. I think each vaccine is out there to specifically prevent against a disease that can be potentially life-threatening to a child. So,
what about people who can't have vaccines? Are there people who can't have them? I mean, people who have perhaps immune system disorders. What about that?
There are folks out there that are not able to get vaccines. Maybe during the course of, for example, the child who has leukemia or would be an example, while they're going through treatment, their immune system is obviously at its lowest point. They are not able to get vaccines, and so those are the students that I refer to when parents are considering vaccinations. Those are the children in the school system that are most vulnerable to the diseases that are circulating out there. The good thing or the flip side of that is once the child has successfully completed treatment, they are able to get vaccinated. So,
okay. Earlier in the program, we heard from Amber Frisket. She is co-founder of Wisconsin United for Freedom. She kind of gave an overview of her organization's views on why they oppose vaccinations. One of the things that she brought up, Doctor, is foreign matter in vaccines. Is that a thing? I mean, is that something that we should be concerned about?
Well, during manufacturing of any vaccine, there can be all sorts of things that are used, highly regulated, highly tested through the FDA for, you know, both the safety, making sure it does not interfere with the vaccine. And in reality, the amounts that are contained in vaccines are smaller than minuscule. Okay, they're very trace. This alarms a number of people, but I will remind people that back in the day when many vaccines contained some mercury as a preservative, they would get more eating a can of tuna than was in the vaccine. Plus, the fact the kind that you would get, for example, eating tuna is the type that will accumulate in your body. The type in vaccines would be excreted very, very quickly and not accumulate. So those are things to kind of keep in mind. I think she also mentioned the potential of human DNA, and in fact, that is true. There are four vaccines that we have out there that are formed from human diploid cell lines. If you remember a story about Henrietta Lacks, who was a woman with cervical cancer, her cell line has been perpetuated for greater than 50 years and has led to many medical breakthroughs. Two vaccine strains or two vaccine cell lines were from therapeutically aborted fetuses back in the 1960s, one in the United Kingdom, one in the U.S. And these have been used to create vaccines for rubella, for hepatitis A, for rabies, and I believe varicella or chickenpox. So absolutely true. Though this is a situation where various religious groups, including, for example, the Vatican, has been involved and says that that parents who choose to avoid vaccines because of this are doing so taking unnecessary risks for their children. So from all the way up to the level of the Pope, there has been support. There's also been requests or suggestions that, for example, there would be a preference to develop vaccines not using these cell lines. There's endorsement that they actually work. I'll just do one aside here, that rubella, which is an enormous terrible condition, especially if you're pregnant and have it causing fetal loss, causing congenital lifelong problems, causing early death in children, has been eliminated in the entire Western Hemisphere with the use of a simple vaccine. And I just wanted to follow, I'm sorry, I'm talking a lot, but follow up on one point.
It's okay.
In terms of at any one time out there in our population, roughly 10 million Americans of all ages are immunosuppressed or immunocompromised due to illness, due to cancer mm-hmm. chemotherapy, or due to other drugs. And these are people that we can't recognize when we see them in the grocery store, but they're out there. And by having everyone vaccinated, we're not only protecting ourselves, but we're protecting these highly vulnerable individuals.
Melanie, with the Portage County Public Health Department, how often does your department field questions like this about the safety and efficacy of immunizations?
I don't know that the public health department per se. I mean, we do have callers that call in and do have questions about vaccine safety. The group of employees that I have that are in the schools, so the school nurses, they field questions about vaccine safety all the time.
Okay. You know, I've got to bring this up because this is the one thing that for years was circulating. Is there a link between vaccination and autism? Is there a scientific basis to that argument?
No.
Okay. Where did that all get started?
This got started basically through a doctor by the name of Andrew Wakefield, practiced in the United Kingdom, and in 1998 authored a paper that looked at a number of cases of children with autism and purported to show that they received a measles-containing vaccine and developed autism. As time has gone on, however, it turns out that almost all of the co-authors on this paper recanted their authorship, saying that we were not told that Dr. Wakefield had high financial interests in this. He was a paid expert witness. People didn't know that he was trying to make his own measles vaccine at the same time. Mm-hmm. And as time has gone on, it turns out that he falsified data, and he created situations that were not there. And also, he violated human subjects protections in the UK. Because of that, the United Kingdom stripped him of his medical license. The journal, a highly prestigious journal, The Lancet, expunged the paper from its files, basically. It said this paper never happened because this is falsified. And he has left the UK, is a multimillionaire living in Texas, and continues to push unproven theories to his adherents. But that's the origin of this. There have been dozens now of very well-done scientific studies that show absolutely no correlation or no relationship between receipt of a vaccine, receipt of milligrams of antigen or the chemicals in the vaccine, or mercury, for that, from older vaccines that were in existence before, and the development of autism. There is no relationship at all.
All right. As we pointed out earlier, every state requires kindergartners to be up to date on the vaccines recommended by the CDC to enroll in school or childcare, whether it's a private or public school. Children who are allergic to a vaccine ingredient or they have a damaged immune system, they can get a medical exemption. But we also see a growing number of kindergartners across Wisconsin that are lacking some or all of their shots. I was taking a look at the rates. Three Lakes Junior High School, 83%, Park Falls Elementary, 83%, Northland Pines Montessori, 75%, LaPointe mm-hmm. Elementary in Ashland County, 60%, Tomorrow River Virtual Charter School, 40%. The remaining 60% of those students are claiming personal exemptions. What do you think is leading to this trend where people are resisting those vaccinations? Melanie, maybe you can answer that.
I think a lot of the things that have been talked about already. The fear that, or parents have fears that vaccines may cause undue harm to their child. They also have fear that the vaccines will cause autism. What I would encourage the parents to do is to go to reputable websites such as the CDC or the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, the American Academy of Pediatrics, and read some of the articles and the studies that have been done on the safety of vaccinations, to maybe put aside some of the myths that are out there. But I also do wonder if sometimes parents don't always want to, you know, sometimes children are due for maybe 5 or 6 vaccinations, and so they don't want to get the child vaccinated with, say, 4 or 5 shots. It has been proven that, you know, the amount of vaccines that you give, obviously, the more vaccines that you give, if the child is going to run a fever or whatever, it's hard to know which vaccine caused that. But it has been proven that a child can get multiple vaccines at one time. So it's sometimes it's just personal preference. And so when the child comes into school, maybe they don't have all of the shots, but they may be behind or in process of getting them. So I think there's multiple things out there that we're seeing.
A handful of states still offer the non-medical exemptions, but they require parents to show that they've received information about the efficacy of vaccines or talked with a doctor before deciding. What are your thoughts on that? Would that be effective?
You know, the school nurses spend a lot of time speaking with, especially the kindergartners coming into school, talking to the parents about vaccine safety. And so I don't know. I think it may be a way that it could help, but I do know that if parents are going to, you know, choose to not vaccinate the child, it is their preference. And so the only thing we can do is just give them the correct information and, you know, encourage them to get the child vaccinated. But, okay.
I wanted to circle back to what Amber Pisquette said. She is co-founder of the Wisconsin United for Freedom group. She mentioned something called vaccine injury. Doctor, how common are injuries related to vaccinations?
Well, it depends what you call an injury. So I can say every time I go in and get my flu shot, I have an injury because someone stuck a needle into my arm. But that's something that usually I forget about within 2 minutes. When I get a tetanus, diphtheria, and a cellular pertussis vaccine, my arm is sore for a couple days after that. Is that an injury? It is, but it's expected. The Congress created the Vaccine Injury Compensation Fund, which your guest had alluded to, which is it's funded through a 50-cent tax on all the vaccines that are marketed for children in this country. And this is a fund that provides compensation for known injuries, albeit rare injuries. So, for example, there are conditions that can occur after a vaccine, and they might happen at a rate of 1 in 100,000 or 1 in 500,000. But if you can show that you have the vaccine and you have one of these conditions that's on what's called a table of known adverse effects, that this is something that is compensated without having to do any trial or so on. It is true that there have been several millions, I guess, in the way of billions of dollars, probably $4 billion, dispensed over the lifetime of this fund. But this fund is actually aggregating money faster than it goes out. This was actually created because many vaccine manufacturers years ago were going to get out of the business in making vaccines, and this is a public health emergency. Congress stepped in by creating this fund. And we also heard that that manufacturers were shielded from litigation. And this is all part of the same package. This assures that we have a vaccine pipeline in this country that provides this life-saving condition.
Okay. Okay. Unfortunately, that is all we have time for today. We could talk about this for hours, I think. I'm Shereen Seward. This is Route 51. I'd like to thank our guests, Portage County Public Health Nursing Supervisor Melanie Baer, UW-Madison vaccination and microbiology expert Dr. Jonathan Tempte, and Republican State Senator Patrick Teston. Our executive producer is Rick Ryer. Our on-air producer today is Joy Ratchkramer. Thanks to John Altenberg for the Route 51 theme. You can hear the archive of today's program at WPR.org/Route 51. Next week, we'll offer up a list of suggestions for the best fall road trips and festivals in the state, including Project North. It's a brand new festival that debuts this fall in Rhinelander. Until then, we're heading out of town.